Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr., and we're really excited for today. We have a special guest. We say that about every guest that comes on, but this guy is really special. They're all very special in their own way. I've been posting about every 6 months I post about lipedema, and I'm not an expert in it. I just have to know enough about it to be able to diagnose it, since it can be similar to obesity. It can be kind of confused with obesity. So today we have Dr. David Amron in here, who's a specialist, has been referred to as are you the grandfather? Is that how your peers refer to you?
Well,
the
grandfather? I just turned 63 with my white beard, so I fit the role. But I began this whole field over 25 years ago.
So. Oh, gosh. We got the guy here.
Yeah. Well, you're the man. And this is a big deal for a lot of people, obviously preaching to the choir, because the reason we have to know about it and we need more awareness is because it's a very frustrating thing and can be pretty debilitating, huh?
Yes, all correct. Yeah.
All right. So, what's your background in? How'd you get into this?
Yeah. So I'm a dermatologic surgeon. I've been in practice now 29 years. And I began my practice focusing on liposuction. Now you might say, well, why liposuction in dermatology? We developed something called tumescent liposuction in the mid-1980s, the derm surgeons, Jeff Klein and others. So it really is kind of in our neck of the woods. And it's that one more significant cosmetic surgical procedure that derms can get into. So I began to focus my whole practice around that 29 years ago. And once you do that, you know, you say, I'm specializing in this. You begin to get a lot of complicated types of things, complicated revision work, and then this whole thing about complicated areas that nobody was doing over 25 years ago, like calves and ankles and forearms. And I was one that really pioneered the techniques of these areas back then. And that's what led the lipedema community to find me, because I was focusing so much on that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So they're like, okay, I have this problem area on my legs. And that's how they found you. And you're like, all right, I'll start working on it and figure out some techniques there.
Well, even before that, I began to do these areas and get a reputation for doing a lot of calves and ankles when nobody was doing them. And again, I, at that point, wasn't even aware about lipedema. I just was doing calves and ankles and circumferential thighs. And I already developed my techniques for these areas. And then even years later, I was doing this makeover show in Europe. My ex-partner, Paul Nassif, the guy was on that botch show, Facial Plastics, and he was doing nose jobs and facelifts. And I was doing all the lipo. It was appearing in Europe. And I showed patients that I was doing calf ankle liposuction on. And all of a sudden, I had all these European women from France and Germany and England coming to me saying, Dr. Amron, I've got lipedema. I want you to make my calves and ankles beautiful. And I'm lipedema.
You're like, what the hell are you talking about?
This condition. Wait. You know, you've got fullness in your calves and ankles. I do over and over again with it. And that's when it really clicked. Like all those patients I was doing for all those years had lipedema.
That's so interesting.
So you didn't know at that time about lipedema. You were doing it, but you didn't know exactly that it was different. And we're going to talk about how it's different than the disease of obesity that we often discuss. Now I'm sure, how long has anybody known about this being, you know, a different pathophysiology than, you know, obesity itself?
Yeah. So good question. So, you know, you go back to the history of lipedema, which is what I did, you know, right away. And I researched this condition. I'm like, oh, you know, there are some papers about lipedema. And it goes back to 1940 at the Mayo Clinic. Two authors, Allen and Hines, wrote a landmark paper about this condition of swelling and pain in the legs. And you know what? They pretty much nailed it. They were right on in terms of the description of that condition, and they called it lipedema. And there was a subsequent paper years later. So it was defined back then. Problem is that it never made its way to medical school education. And we know as doctors, you know, we hear something, you know, some unusual thing. We go through our, what I call a Rolodex of 5,000 diseases that we learn in medical school. Say, lipedema, I've never heard about that. And to add insult to injury, it sounds too much like lymphedema.
Yeah.
So I got confused with it. And I think that we just gave it a little bit of a weak name, lipedema. It sounds like some made up name, you know, fat and swelling. I actually years ago suggested lipofibroedema as a more accurate description. It sounds more like a real disease. So, you know, it never made its way to medical school education. And because of that, as doctors, you know, when you hear of it later on, you think it doesn't exist. And that's part of the pervasive ignorance that continues to go on. You know, only about 10% at most of physicians know what lipedema is or have heard of it. Most just don't because they never learned how to medical school.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I can tell you 100% that it was never taught in medical school where I was.
We just got into it because we were into
obesity medicine
and you know, endocrine and the metabolic disorders. And so we were, you know, kind of in our own studying, I guess, outside of.
Well, that's great.
Our mainstream residency and fellowships. But
you guys are at the forefront of stuff. That's why when I looked at, you know, your social media stuff, I saw posts about lipedema. I said, that's fantastic. You know, that you're aware of it and you're representing, because really anybody in obesity medicine, including bariatric surgeons, should know about lipedema. And quite honestly, I'm going to say, as we can get into this, patients with obesity should be screened for lipedema.
Yeah.
So can you, all right. So just for anybody else, can you give the layman's term? What the heck is lipedema? What is this?
Yep. Okay. My little elevator speech.
Yeah, let's hear it. I want to hear the patient friendly and doctor friendly version.
Right,
yeah.
So I'll try to be succinct, but get to all the important points. So lipedema is a fat storage condition, very under-recognized, we know, around the U.S., identified way back when. Typically will begin presenting at puberty with the hormonal changes. Affects about 10 or 11% of the female population. That sounds like a mind-blowing number, but there's so many what's called stage 1 and stage 2 patients that have mild lipedema. They're not all like the things you look at on the internet with very large, painful legs. There's a lot of mild lipedema out there, which we can talk about. Presents at puberty, genetically inherited, and the pattern of inheritance is autosomal dominant. Now, you guys know what that is because you're docs, but most of your viewers don't. So autosomal dominant means you pick up a gene from a parent, and in equal frequency, a mother or a father could be carrying the gene. So there's many men walking around the gene of lipedema as women, but it's rarely expressed in men. So you look for a family history of it. On the mom's side, she might have it, or the father's side. The dad's carrying the gene, you gotta look at the females. His mother, maybe his grandmother, his sisters, and almost always you'll find evidence of it. Presents at puberty, like I mentioned, gets progressively worse, increases in activity with other hormonal changes endocrinologically with pregnancy, menopause, OBGYN surgery will flare it up with it. Different stages, 1 through 4. There's mild, there's very advanced. Can affect the lymphatic system and turn to lipolymphedema. Has a characteristic look. This is hugely important. Lipedema patients are disproportionate in characteristic patterns, okay? The common pattern is a column-like look to the legs from the groin down to the ankle. Many times there's cuffing of the ankle. The upper buttock area is involved about half the patients. Some patients with type 2 will not have involvement in the calf and ankle areas. So it's not always this column-like look. Abdomen and back less commonly involved, but can be involved. Arms, about 90% of patients. Forearms can become secondarily involved with it. And then along with that, characteristic symptoms, not just signs, but symptoms. Tenderness to pressure is common in about 90% of patients, but not always. Easy bruisability, swelling, and then 85% of patients have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome with hypermobility or hyperflexibility of joints and skin. So we'll talk about that, how it plays into the pathophysiology and the connective tissue abnormality in these patients.
Huh. Everybody always asks this. Why is the fat tissue different than subcutaneous, normal
and
subcutaneous? And why? Yeah. What's the dish? Okay.
So we'll talk about that. We'll get into some of the, you know, what we know from the science and pathophysiology. One thing I just forgot to mention, though, when I described lipedema, this is hugely important. Pretty much unresponsive to diet and exercise.
Yeah.
Now, there are a lot of things preventively that are important to do. We'll talk about. But generally, these patients from a young age are told, eat less and exercise more, and they're blamed and shamed. Many have eating disorders emotionally. They're affected by this. They try everything they can. They go down the rabbit hole of weight loss therapies, many times culminating in weight loss surgery. About a third of patients that I see have had bariatric surgery because they're misdiagnosed as obese, primarily based on archaic BMI indexes that I'm so passionate to talk about in pretty much a negative way, because I don't like the BMI index as a way of judging patients. I think it's an outdated way of looking at things. It's an old 200-year-old system. And they get weight loss surgery and it doesn't respond. So again, generally unresponsive diet and exercise.
The way I describe it to patients is, you know, as an endocrinologist, right, and things, I say it's the fat that's in lipedema is not really metabolically engaged with everything else going on in the body. It's like its own thing. It doesn't, like you said, it doesn't respond to the metabolic therapies from diet, exercise to medicine and surgery.
Bariatric surgery. Yeah. I mean, liposuction, we'll get into that.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, it generally doesn't respond to endocrinologic stuff. And I'm going to say it's a little bit hit or miss. You know, Karen Herbst, who I'm very closely associated with, leading researcher and endocrinologist who really excels at fat disorders clinically, you know, we talked about this. And it's a little bit hit or miss in terms of how patients respond to bioidentical hormones or things, you know, they're going through menopause. Some patients get better, some patients get worse, most patients don't change with it. What was it you asked me again?
Well, just like it's like the fat cells in, or the fat in lipedema.
Oh, have their own mind.
It's not part of like the metabolic processes of the body generally.
It can't be used as fuel.
Right. You can't be. Basically, yes. Not really a fuel storage source. It's like, it's kind of off in its own world.
It's all compartmentalized almost.
Yeah. You know what? It's kind of a good way of looking at it. It has a sort of a mind of its own. And I think we should start talking about pathophysiology.
Yeah. Let's hear it. Cause I always talk about it being like a, almost like connective tissue similar to that.
Yeah.
I don't know. I want to hear the expert talk about it. I don't know.
The pieces of the puzzle are slowly getting put together in our understanding of lipedema. But, hormonally, it kind of has a little bit of a mind of its own. But it does respond to hormonal fluctuations. We know that puberty and pregnancy. The thing about lipedema is when you get to a certain point, usually about stage two, the fat is not only responding to hormones, it's producing hormones like estrogen, other things, because it begins to act like its own endocrinologic organ. Fat is very metabolically active. It's very hormonally active. It's almost like an organ, which it is. So about stage two, patients will begin to be adversely affected metabolically by the lipedema fat, and they will then begin to put on weight in other areas. So then they begin to get secondarily overweight and begin to get more visceral fat in other areas. So in most of my patients after liposuction surgeries, when you've removed all that substrate, their metabolism improves, even if they don't change their diet and exercise, and they then begin to lose weight in other areas.
That's pretty fast.
So yeah, it's metabolically active, but can't even be used as fuel for the body.
Key. Okay.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah, right.
I mean, and we do always talk about, you know, our role with these
fat as an organ
is to try to, you know, support them mentally, emotionally, and try to help them get diagnosed. But we do treat what obesity they do have. It's just we can't get to this part.
Right. So you can help them to a certain degree. Well, first of all, starting on the preventative stuff is hugely important. You know, the proper dietary strategy with lipedema, it's grains and glutens and sugar and alcohol and probably dairy products. And then, you know, other lifestyle things are important. Certainly a lot of that's important. And then, you know, they're from, the GLP-1 agonist stuff we can talk about also. What role may it have in these patients with things? I think it's a little bit more after the surgery, but you can only get them to a certain point. You're right. And then at that point, you know, typically the surgery is necessary to be able to set it back to hopefully more of its inception. But let's jump into pathophysiology.
Because,
all right. So this is what I think is going on with lipedema. You know, I got to just do a little plug for my book here. There's a book, Liposuction and Lipedema Surgery, A Guide for the Patient, Pearls for the Surgeon. It came out on Amazon. You know, honestly, it's a great book. And it's written in ways patients can understand. And it goes into a lot of great information about lipedema and what's going on with it. And even the pathophysiology. There's a whole diagram I have about my understanding of it. So this is what I think is going on with lipedema. We now understand, and this is a hard thing to really, you know, swallow. I think it's not primarily a fat disorder. And the fat cells are just doing their thing as fat cells. They are mitotically replicating. We kind of know that. And there's inflammation, this and that going on. But a key piece of evidence happened in 2016. I was at a conference called FTRS, and a PhD, I can't remember her name, Gail, somebody here, presented her research. And it showed in lipedema patients that there's an increased permeability through lymphatic membranes, where there is a leakiness of lymphatic membranes and fluid is moving out, taking along stem cells that get implanted in the layer of fat. They differentiate in from pre-adipocytes into mature fat cells, but they are younger fat cells, and they begin mitotically replicating, which is a little different than what we think about, you know, fat cells. You're kind of taught, you know, you're born a certain number of cells, and they expand and contract. You're not developing new cells in areas, but here you actually are developing new cells. That's why we will see pre-tibial fat in lipedema patients. I'm like, how the hell did the fat get there? Years ago, I'm thinking, how did fat cells get in front of that tibia bone there? Were the patients born with it? No. Well, then how did it get there? But now we understand, because there's movement of the stem cells through the lymphatic membranes. They differentiate when they're in the subcutaneous layer because they find themselves in the milieu, the environment of other fat cells. They start replicating as young cells. They die off because their replication can't be supported. And then you get inflammation to start trying to clear up the dying off fat cells with what? Macrophages. Now, we know macrophages are your cleaner up cells in histopathology. It's not your autoimmune cells like lymphocytes. So the inflammation that happens is not an autoimmune process. It's cleaning up the dying off fat cells. But then it incites chronic inflammation, okay? And that lead about to what's called fibrosis.
Okay.
That scar tissue builds up more and more. It increases the hydrostatic pressure in the areas. The process begins to get worse and worse. You'll get secondary areas involved in like forearms and stuff like that. And now you're off and running with it. And then eventually it can begin to damage the lymphatics with that fibrosis and put that patient at risk of what's called lipolymphedema. So I think we're eventually going to find that lipedema is a genetically inherited autosomal pattern of inheritance of a defect of something in connective tissue. Probably it's elastin or something like that, where there's a weakness of connective tissue. And that's the primary thing going on. Now, why do I say that? There's all these other commonalities. You got Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. That's purely connective tissue disease. Weakness of joints and tendons. These patients have more injuries with joints and tendons. They've got Ehlers-Danlos. They've been diagnosed with it commonly. You have leaky gut syndrome in a lot of patients.
The Ehlers-Danlos thing is, I guess I wasn't really aware of that connection.
So 85% of the patients have variations of the 11 types of Ehlers-Danlos. You know, I ask patients, you know, were you or are you more flexible, you know, the average person either now or when you were young? I go, yeah, you know, I could bend my fingers back. I could do splits, you know, this and that. Many of them find their way into yoga and ballet and cheerleading, things that take advantage of that. So they have almost always a laxity of their connective tissue. And that's part of the pathophysiology. I actually think it's the main thing going on. And the fat is a secondary phenomenon where you get the mood of fat cells. Now, why do I also say that? Because I I fairly commonly use lipedema fat for fat transfer. I've done it for over 12 years. And at first I was a little bit, you know, perplexed, you know, is it safe and this and that? And now that I understand more the pathophysiology, you know, I think it's completely safe and I've never had an issue with it. So the fat cells, you can take the fat cells from lipedema, you can use it for transfer to breast, to buttock, even the face, and never have a problem with it because it's not only about the fat cells. The fat cells are actually young, almost like more embryonic fat cells. It's the whole process going on. That's weakness of connective tissue. It's inflammation. It's the hormonal insults that make it worse with it. At some point, you know, the metabolic system gets to be adversely affected. You begin to get more overweight with it. And that's what I think is the pathophysiology of lipedema. And that's what we, you know, basically know right now, but we need more and more research about this.
So when you take the fat out, does it look different from the subcutaneous fat that you take out of other places, or does it all look the same?
It's a good question. You know, it generally looks different, and it looks different primarily because there is more fibrosis. Okay. Once you kind of purify it and you separate things, and I use that for transfer, the fat cells pretty much look similar. They look more yellow. So lipedema fat is generally going to be whiter in fat. Normal fat in people that don't have lipedema is more yellow in fat. It looks a little bit more like chicken fat, which is more yellow. Whereas lipedema fat skews more towards almost like being like beef fat. It's got a whiter quality to it. The more fibrous a person is, which makes sense because fibrous tissue is scar tissue, the whiter it looks with it. And then there we can, there's different patterns of fibrosis. Another thing I've identified, there's nodular, which stands for that lumpy type of feeling under the skin. There's granular, there's strandy, which holds on a swelling. There's dense fibrosis, which puts the person at risk of lipolymphedema.
So it's my understanding is the fibrosis and that changes in elasticity, and that's what kind of compartmentalizes it, and the lymph issue is what makes it incapable of being used as fuel. Am I thinking about that right? Yeah, or is that
when
the
when you're saying incapable of being used as fuel,
when you go diet and exercise and bariatric surgery, getting in a energy deficit, eating fewer calories than you burn, but you don't see the changes in the legs.
Yeah. Why is its metabolic pool like untappable?
Yeah.
I never thought about it in terms of that. I'm just thinking in terms of disproportion, you know, an imbalance that goes on. That's a whole other thing to discuss. You know, why when people that, you know, have a genetic disproportion without lipedema, they got huge saddlebags without lipedema, why is it generally not responding as much with diet and exercise? I kind of think of it like, you know, the fat are stupid storage units. They're just going to do what they're doing, you know? And if you've got disproportion, you lose a whole bunch of weight, you're going to disproportionately, you know, not remove from that area as much. So you have a girl with a skinny, bony upper body. She's got huge saddlebags. Her mom has it. Her sister, that's genetic disproportion. That might respond as well also to diet and exercise. And that's why those patients are told, you know, lose more weight, exercise. And they get so skinny in other areas because of that disproportionate imbalance.
Yeah.
And those patients really need liposuction. Whereas your proportionate patient who is just overweight needs to lose weight and do things metabolically and all that stuff. With lipedema, you have that disproportion also. And I think that that's a big reason why you're not losing it more from those areas. But you're right. The fat actually gets walled off.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're right. It compartmentalizes. And the fibrosis all around it kind of traps those cells there with it, with the inflammation. They get trapped and then they start dying off and stuff. Yeah, the inflammation, it gets worse, the fibrosis with it. So you're right. Those fat cells are almost like, you know, compartmentalized. And that's probably also why they don't respond as well to other things.
Yeah, that's my basic understanding of it. But I'll never forget one of my first patients with it. I was using weight loss medicines and just like, it was not, there were not changing. And I was like, you know, this is lipedema. Like, no doubt about it.
It is pretty dramatic.
It's very predictable. It's not going to respond.
Yeah.
It's very obvious when it's real, you know, when it's obvious, right? But,
you know, God bless you. Because these poor patients have just been through everything, you know, and it starts from a young age. I mean, it's just, they've been told and, like I said, shamed and blamed and family and others. And, you know, and then they get into, you know, these personal trainers or healthcare systems or doctors are negating it. They try everything themselves, Weight Watcher stuff, metabolic things, surgery. They get misdiagnosed for a whole bunch of other things. They even venous insufficiency, which they may have a little of. They're doing vein therapies, thinking that's the problem with it. Their vein doctors are not recognized as lipedemas. The main part of their swelling in their legs. They're getting just misdiagnosed with fibromyalgia, peripheral neuropathy with the referred pain, plantar fasciitis. Many of them go down, you know, with more and more issues with orthopedic things because of that fibrosis around their knee joints. Not only the weight of these patients, they have orthopedic issues. Their orthopedists either are operating or not operating because their BMI indexes are too high. It just goes on and on and on. They've spent years, they spent thousands of their own dollars. They've wasted insurance dollars on things. It's just craziness. And then eventually, I'm so sorry, eventually who diagnoses them? Who? Themselves.
Yeah.
They go on the internet, which is, thank God, filled with information these days, and they find a pair of legs that looks like them, or their husband sees those, legs, and they come across this term lipedema, and they start reading about it, and then they almost are filled with these, like, you know, weird emotions. I call it their aha moments. Like, and they're basically self-diagnosed themselves. It's just crazy.
Yeah. And so speaking of that, so, you know, you mentioned your book, which, you know, we can link to.
We'll put the link in.
You know, I give patients the www.lipedema.org. Is that, I don't know if you're involved with that. But like patient information.
It's a Lipedema Foundation, basically.
LF's a great organization. You know, they were very involved in research. You know, we see them all the conferences. They pick my brain in terms of where we think research should go with stuff like that. I mean, a great organization. They fund a lot of research, and they're getting more into now education of patients and healthcare.
Yeah.
That's a very good resource. Yeah, there's other good resources also.
Okay, so who's going to, if somebody somehow gets self-diagnosed or diagnosed, where do they go? Because, like, I don't think I would probably just send them to you, even though you're in Hollywood. You can't be the only surgeon. Who else is doing this?
I'll tell you, there's a lipedema, physician's website.
Network.
And I'll tell you, I actually had a bad experience with my most recent one. We sent to somebody where I am in Michigan, and it just didn't work out. I don't know that the guys on the website, I'm not going to, you know, throw him under the bus, but, you know, I think he's some sort of vascular surgeon, maybe, rather than, you know, what you are, which actually makes a little more sense.
Well,
but,
you know,
so how do you, it's a
how do you know who's good?
Okay. All right. So, I mean, I'll try to answer this professionally, but I'm getting too old sometimes, you know, not speak my mind about things.
You know what? What podcast we're on right now?
Yeah, you can. You're allowed. Say it
how you feel like comfortable saying. Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. Okay. So to begin with, listen, I don't want everybody with lipedema or think that. Okay, first of all, if patients think they have lipedema, I mean, I hate to kind of say they usually probably do. It kind of all makes sense in terms of what they're experiencing, the way in which their legs look, the symptoms. You know, some of the family history. It's not that complicated to diagnose. Basically, how does it look? What are the symptoms? And is there family history? And if it kind of looks and smells like lipedema, it probably is. When patients come to me, you know, 99% of the time, they're right about it. You know, yes, it is good to get diagnosed by an individual, either in person or through virtual diagnoses. And we offer that. But it's hard to find people who, first of all, many times can even diagnose lipedema. You know, I hear this all the time, patients from, you know, different areas, you know, there's nobody in my area to diagnose lipedema. So getting diagnosed is an important thing. Secondly, you know, if you think you have it or you're officially diagnosed, I don't want every patient to think they've got to rush into surgery, even though that's, you know, yes, certainly what I specialize in. There are a lot of important preventive things that patients should do. They should understand respectful dietary strategies for lipedema. There's a lot of good information about out there. There's good books out there for it, and get on a diet. And this doesn't mean just dieting. This is the problem. They've been told just diet their whole life. It's avoiding the triggers of lipedema, gluten, grains, alcohol, dairy products, sugar, and then it goes on to a whole number of other things.
So so quality diet, so we get into this a lot.
Dietary patterns. You're saying
a lot of things that have, you know, that respond to dietary patterns and stuff. Some of those things that you just mentioned, are there very specific known, you know, pathological triggers from those things, or just like patterns that we've noticed, or, because people, you know, we talk a lot about some of these nutritional extremes out there, and, you know, most people don't need to avoid gluten because not many people have celiac, but a lot of people need to avoid the processed refined foods that are often packed with gluten. So is it the gluten in that respect, or is it just the refined processed wheat products? You know what I mean? Like kind of the inflammatory
milieu. Okay, I'm going to say this. I purposefully, I know it sounds weird, you know, stay away a little bit from a lot of the nuances of that because it's not my area of specialization to give all the detailed nutritional guidance with things. We actually do that to a certain degree as part of our program as some basic guidance. But after that, you know, we look to refer to people like you who know better than I do about some of the nuances. There are a lot of diets that are respectful of lipedema. So somebody has to find one that is doing 90% plus of the work of it and be able to live on it. Some are very restrictive, like just purely ketogenic diets. Karen Herbst, for example, loves what's called the RAD diet, R-A-D diet, that's a little bit, you know, less restrictive. So, you know, I'm going to defer to others and the information out there, and patients should learn about it. There's a good book written by Karen Herbst and Emily Eichner and a bunch of other authors. We can put a link to that possibly, you know, on there also, that gives great information about it. But so starting on a dietary respectful strategy is important, number one. Number two, you know, compression is important with lipedema. As we talked about, swelling is an important component. It's actually one of the first components you see. Even in a girl's at a young age, they're getting swelling going on. So controlling swelling is important, and that involves generally compression strategies and therapy. Compression garments is the first mainstay, you know, either on a daily basis for those who are really swelling, or even intermittently when they exercise or it's hot outside when they travel. And then actually having a relationship with a decongestive therapist, you know, somebody who's like a certified lymphatic therapist. They can find one in their area. There's many resources to find lymphatic therapists around the country. And having a relationship with a lymphatic therapist is important, because those two things are important for prevention of lipedema. And that's, again, why we should be diagnosing at a young age. Pediatricians, OBGYN should be screening for lipedema. So those two things are important. And finally, you know, trying to avoid the hormonal fluctuations of things to some degree. Some things you can control, other things you can't control with it. And that's a little more challenging, I got to say. That's an area, that's an evolving area. We're actually looking to expand into that area to understand how things like bioidenticals might play a role in lipedema prevention. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. So I'm interested, you know, that the lymphatic therapy, does that, because a lot of people have pain, you know, like you said, pain with the swelling and stuff like that. Does that help, you know, the compression and the lymphatic, is it kind of like a lymphatic massage sort of thing, right? Does that help with reduced pain?
So, you know, the general answer is, you know, yes, it does help. I think it's individual by patient by patient. Some patients, it helps a lot. It helps to move the fluid along. It's not only the only important thing. There's many different things that are important. So compression therapy with garments is probably, you know, equally as important with it. Proper lymphatic massage by a qualified therapist, and not just, you know, any massage therapy. You know, you want to find somebody who is really understands lipedema and lymphedema and knows how to do those types of massages. Some patients need compression pumps, either compression pump therapy in centers, like physical therapy centers, or home compression pumps that can be added to it. There's other things like vibrational plate therapy that can help. There's dry brushing. There's a number of different decongestive strategies. I mean, we do all these things in my center, you know, here in Los Angeles and now in Utah. So, you know, to answer your question, we opened up a center in Utah also for diagnosis and preventative therapies and decongestive therapy. I've got decongestive therapists in both centers. You know, we diagnose patients also, not only a surgery, but getting a relationship with a decongestive therapist is also important. Now, to answer your second question about who to see and who to trust with it, you know, one thing is getting diagnosed. And I think that, you know, there are a lot of doctors who can diagnose, like you guys out there and stuff like that, and other doctors who are learning about lipedema. We need to build upon that. Doing the surgeries themselves, you know, I'll try to answer this in a professional way and not make it like look like self-serving, all that stuff. You know, I have a lot of pride in what I've developed, in my technique, in my system. I have pride in what I've done to train surgeons that work underneath me. So I don't just, you know, take people on and I'm very busy and say, oh, I'm booked up with patients, you know, here, go see my associate. I've gone through a very structured fellowship training with my surgeons. It's really been a process of 6 to 12 months with each of them to get to the level of doing things exactly the way in which I do it. So I trust that it's going to be done perfectly with it. So I've set up a very systematized approach to things. And that's the whole thing. Like, people are trying to figure things out now, and there's different approaches and different ways of doing it. It's hard for patients to understand, you know, who to go to with it. Yes, I have a lot of experience. That certainly helps with it. But you are, I will say this, you're getting a lot of increased interest in lipedema surgery. Now, that's a good thing, okay? But then again, you know, what has been their training? You know, what has been, you know, who have they really learned from with things? What's their approach? What's their experience? What is their dedication? You know, there's a lot of people I call the dabblers. You know, they'll do, you know, everything, you know, breast surgery and nose jobs and, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, they see lipedema as a marketplace. I'm just going to say that right now. And they'll represent that you do lipedema surgery and they'll start to market for it. But, you know, how many cases have they done? What is their experience? How have they got training? And that's a hard thing now, you know, because there's no real training with things like that necessarily with it. Even board certified plastic surgeons say, oh, I'm a board certified plastic surgeon, I can do lipedema surgery. But again, what have you done really with it? And not only that, how is your center set up? You know, are you dedicated? There's so many considerations with lipedema. This is a disease. It's not just cosmetic liposuction. There's proper pre-care and post-care and decongestive therapy. Do you have that in your center? Are you equipped with it? Is all your staff trained with it? Have you considered hypercoagulable states in these patients? Do you have your prophylaxis of anticoagulation in place with things like that? How can you handle not only your typical lipedema patient, but all the complicated patients, your stage four lipolymphedema patients that have special considerations with it? So, you know, I'm just going to say that, you know, you ideally want to go to somebody with a lot of experience, a place that is dedicated, like, I mean, like we are with it. And I'm not just saying this to be self-serving. I'm proud of what we do here with it and setting the standards of what should go on with it. So, you know, I'm just going to say, do your research with it. Don't just look at it like, oh, this is your quick fix of doing liposuction. I've got lipedema surgery. And, you know, take your time, research, and make sure that who you're trusting is important. There, I just finished. There's a patient I saw yesterday, and this is an example of it. There's a patient, I don't even want to say the state, you know, out of state. And she saw me for a consultation about 3 years ago. And unfortunately, you know, couldn't afford an insurance that we try to battle with it, was not covering it at that point with it. And she's eventually was referred by her insurance to a surgeon in her state, a plastic surgeon that was representing doing lipedema surgery and was in network. And they referred the patient to that surgeon. He did the surgeries on her. And I'm just going to say this, it was so egregious, just made a mess of things and so many complications to clot formation, infections, perforation, ulcerations of her skin. And now she's seeing me to try to make things better with it. But here's an example of just, you know, seeing a surgeon who represents lipedema surgery, even one that was referred by your insurance and had problems with it. So,
boy, that's pretty sad. And I will say, just for everyone out there, as an, you know, we're not surgeons, and in endocrine, I certainly refer a lot of things to surgeons. It is always literally, I mean, it's in like guidelines and all these things to try to get people to high volume centers. And that's what you're talking about. So for anybody out there listening, oh, you know, surgery is a little bit of a different world for us. But so I obviously have people who need to go get pituitary surgeries quite frequently. And, you know, and thyroid and parathyroid. And it's very well established that it is obviously preferable to get to a high volume surgeon who does a lot of those specific surgeries, because surgeries are very technically different than, say, a lot of what we do, you know, that's more cerebral talking about stuff.
Wait, yeah, so do you have a database? Where's all the people that you trained? Do you have a list? People that have come under you? Yeah.
There's a number of surgeons I trained over the years around the world. I trained a surgeon from Morocco, from Colombia, a professor in Great Britain. I trained surgeons in the United States, but I don't do it anymore other than within my program right now, because I don't believe it's enough just to come and spend a weekend with me or a week with me. I really think it takes a lot longer than that. So I do these fellowship things, and at least right now, those are the only people I'm trusting. You know, Dr. Aria here and Dr. Smart in Utah. And we're going to build upon that. And at some point, we may open up to other people who are trained within the ALT program.
Is there a fellowship other than your, you know, your own little fellowship? But is there like an academic fellowship people are like teaching this? Or is this just like, this is like the Wild West where it's like you're trailblazing and hopefully it gets picked up somewhere?
Yeah. So it's a little bit of the latter, I got to say. It's a little of the Wild West. Yeah, there is no yet accredited. Now, you know, accreditation is great with things like that. And, you know, I may go towards accreditation with this thing. You know, right now it is a fellowship that I have developed in a very specific way that actually is incredibly structured, this fellowship. I mean, it's so like, you know, it goes through such a structured process and before anybody is doing surgery themselves. I mean, you know, I'll just tell you, Dr. Smart, for example, you know, he was the head of the program at University of Utah. He's had over 9 years, 10 years experience in liposuction. And I'm putting him through the same structured thing that my other surgeon did with things. And he's now just finishing up his training with me and is going to be doing his surgeries, you know, himself. So it's just not like in medicine, you know, see one, do one, teach one. I mean, it's a structured thing. But you're right. It's right now there's no real accredited thing. There's no accreditation for surgeons too. That's something actually, you know, I'm looking to develop. I have an organization called Lipedema Society, a nonprofit thing, which is about awareness. And through that, I'm looking to develop a certification for lipedema surgeons. At least they've done so many number of cases. There's an exam. There's a proctoring of things that goes on. At least it gives the patient some degree of trust that the surgeon has done so many cases and gone through some type of certification with it. I think getting to more of a formalized accreditation is going to take time. But, you know, the academic centers are not what's leading this right now. You know, it's, I hate to say, kind of what I've developed with it, yeah. What's going on in more private practice. In fact, we get referrals from Harvard and the Mayo Clinic that defined lipedema and Baylor and University of Texas and Stanford for patients. They refer to me because we have the program go on with things like that. And I'm actually looking to build upon that with what we do and clinical studies and research and really lead this area. So it's an interesting thing. I think that, you know, it's my centers are kind of in between private practice, but really academics and moving much more in that area with it. I think it'll be several years until the academic centers are really have caught up in this area with it.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's really cool. And appreciate that's, it.
Yeah, because I just, you know, I post every, I almost have 400,000 followers. Every 6 months I post about it. And yeah. And I get every few... Dr. Cameron's like, what the hell are you guys doing? And then a few weeks later, after I post these, I'll get this influx of messages going, thank you so much for posting that. Because I didn't, like you said before, I didn't even know I had it until you posted about it. And then they'll hopefully go see someone like you. Yeah,
I think primary care awareness is a big deal. And maybe, yeah, you know, that's something that sometimes probably, like our podcast can do. I mean, because, yeah, it's kind of meant for patients, but a lot of primary care doctors, nurse practitioners, they listen to us. And if we can somehow spread the awareness just to,
you know what,
people get
every single touch point, every single avenue I've realized to spread the awareness is hugely important. I mean, even, you know, social media influences, I hate to say years ago, I guess I kind of discounted them, you know, but I began to realize that, you know, they're really great. And especially ones, I mean, there's this group, Lipedema Mamas in Texas,
yeah,
who are two women that just, you know, just do such an amazing job of guidance for patients with lipedema. I did surgery on one and she's continuing to spread the awareness with it. You know, that's why podcasts like this, I think, are great. You know, anything that has to do with, you know, weight loss, obesity, this and that. But, you know, you're right. It's everything. It's primary care physicians. Yeah. You know, I want to, you know, one of my goals is to get out there in front of OBGYNs and pediatricians. Like, you guys got to start screening for this. We screen for diseases that are far less frequent than lipedema we're screening for. We should be screening for lipedema at puberty. It's not that difficult with it.
Yeah, it's a lot of stigma and bias. Yeah, like as you said, which can then worsen everything else. So.
Yep.
It's going to save patients so much. It's going to prevent things. It's going to save them the emotional trauma. It's going to save them, you know, the frustration and pain. I mean, these women that are, you know, I see about 2/3 of them end up crying at some point in their journey, either the consultation, the pre-op visit, you know, the day of surgery, when I sit up to look at their legs, a week after, their husbands cry and hug me. And it's like all the trauma that these women have suffered with it. And then the healthcare costs. That's another thing. You know, the wasted healthcare costs on things like that from all the misdiagnoses and mistreatment from things that go on with it. And again, even bariatric surgery, which I'm gonna just bring this up with it. You know, bariatric surgeons, you know, have to be screening for lipedema. And if it's lipedema, you know, you really want to understand how that plays into it. You know, I'm just gonna say, and I'm gonna argue that patients should not be jumping into bariatric surgery first.
Right.
Okay. You know, quite honestly, patients with lipedema, and this is not a self-serving thing, need to be doing preventive things first with it, but really doing liposuction surgery first. Because if you do that, and you treat the lipedema because it's not going to respond to bariatric surgery. The patients will lose a whole bunch of weight. They might lose over and over again. Patients say, I lost 70 pounds of weight with bariatric surgery. And, you know, the surgeon's saying, well, aren't you happy you lost 70 pounds of weight? But they're saying, but doctor, my legs haven't changed and I'm still in pain. And everybody's kind of scratching their head. That's and then they got to find me with it.
That's devastating.
Right. So the other way around is what you go on, because they became obese secondarily because of their lipedema, because it metabolically handicapped them. If you treat the lipedema first and you remove all that hormonally active fat and you decongest them, their life changes very quickly. Their pain goes away. Their legs change. Everything changes. And then they begin to lose weight. And you know what? They probably don't need the bariatric surgery.
It's an interesting paradigm shift. I'm sure you're talking with all these academic places. It would be really cool to kind of see that in a very like controlled, systematic way. Because if that's the case, that should be the standard of care. It would just be cool to see research
about awareness. I mean, well, that's the thing. Bariatric surgeons need to have an awareness because sometimes they just get churning and burning through people, and obesity is such a problem right now that it's, you know, I guess, you know, I can understand.
Yeah.
That, but this is a nuanced thing that needs awareness.
Yeah. Again, I'm 63, so I speak my mind, as you can tell. I've earned it, but you know, there's a surgeon in Europe, a bariatric surgeon, who's basically still saying that he believes lipedema does not exist. It's a made up disease. And that just really upsets me and angers me with things. And I really wonder and question, why is he saying that with him? Yeah, you know, I'm not saying that bariatric should never go on with it or for other patients, but I'm just saying it should be diagnosed as lipedema if that's what's going on with it and properly triaged. So you guys want to talk about GLP-1 agonists and lipedema?
We're
hearing a lot of anecdotes about improved pain and weight loss, but and maybe some decreases in the fat that's in lipedema, but most people are discussing the decreases in pain that they're in, swelling that they're noticing
due to reduced weight,
inflammation. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, just
you guys are great. I mean, you just the way you think through things, you're just like right on with it. So you know, first of all, I think I've said these medications are game changers. I think they're just amazing medications. And I think that, you know, in medicine, we weigh out benefits and risks. I think that the benefits are hugely important and what they're doing to transform, you know, lives and medicine in general in all these different ways. And they're great GLP-1 agonists. I think that their role in lipedema, you know, is interesting. I think that predictably, I think that for most patients, it's another weight loss strategy. And that's clinically what I see in Lilly, you know, hundreds and probably over 1,000 patients now that I've seen that have been on it with it. They will lose weight predictably, but generally their areas of lipedema aren't going to respond the same way. It's just another weight loss strategy with it. Now, that said, you used a word anecdotally that is right, Spencer. There seems to be a subset of patients who actually respond favorably to it. That I don't know what that percentage is, you know, 2%, 5%, 10%, 20%, but there seems to be a subset, and I think it's about 5 or 10%, that go on GLP-1s and their pain reduces with it.
Yeah.
Most patients, it doesn't. Now, Carl said the other thing correctly also. Is it because there's something specific about these medications, or are they taking in less inflammatory products that may be causing pain? I think it may be the latter going on a lot of patients, but it's hard to say. We actually need some better studies about this.
Yeah, I think that's cool. So there's a lot of people going, can you guys do a randomized controlled trial? And be like, it'd be great. Let's get some money.
We began that. My doctor Ari has spoken in Germany about GLP-1 agonists and lipedema. We have a small cohort. We're going to build upon that.
Oh, very great. Cool.
That's awesome.
Well, where can everybody find you? We'll put your book in the link. I know you have your Instagram.
Yeah, I've got things I'm supposed to read out here.
Yeah, read it out.
You can find my name. There's, you know, David Amron. There's Amron MD, my main website. We've got the advanced lipedema treatment.com is the main website. The Roxbury Institute's another website for the center itself. What else here? www.advancedlipedematreatment.com. Oh, a phone number, 424-333-9944. But, you know, you just Google me and you find all my little things and entities and Roxburn suit and all that stuff.
Go, check out Hollywood and you go see Dr. Amron.
Well, LA, Beverly Hills, but yeah, and then Utah also. One thing I just want to say is finally is this, you know, obesity and BMI indexes, which we didn't talk about, we can do that in another segment, you know, is another thing that people need to understand when they use the words as being overweight, what that really means. You know, if you're looking at yourself just being overweight, literally by a number on a scale and a BMI index, it's not the whole story. You've got to understand also, you know, is there disproportion or are you just overweight? If there's disproportion, you know, it may be lipedema really. And just don't just judge yourself only by a number on a scale with because that's the whole problem. Right into, you're labeled as being obese and you go down that rabbit hole of weight loss and maybe bariatric surgery and you have to like understand. That's why I don't like the BMI index.
Right. Yeah, you're preaching. We talk about it as a screener, but you have to look holistically.
I help with guideline writing for diagnosis and
it's tough.
And it gets right in line with us. And
we got to get the insurance companies on board. Hopefully other doctors look beyond their computer when they're looking at a patient and talking to them and assessing them. Because muscularity and lipidemia, those things can make a big difference. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on. This is tremendous.
You guys are great. Thank you guys so much for all you do. Thank you for having me on, be able to, you know, share my knowledge about this area, and thank you for spreading words for this.
Yeah, you got it. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.